My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week we are joined by the host of Monsters Among Us, Derek Hayes, to cover his love of cryptids, spooky stories, and much more. I've been a fan of Derek's show since it hit the airwaves 4 years ago, so I was delighted to finally speak to him one-on-one. We cover spooky stories, animal ghosts, Bigfoot, Dogman, UFOs, and much, much more, as well as the first call that gave him the chills. Anyway, in the rest of the world, lockdown continues for the majority of us. Thankfully, me and my family are safe and well. So wherever you are in the world, I hope you and your loved ones are safe too. Take care. And if nothing else, lockdown's good for catching up on some great documentaries. So if you've not had a chance to catch up with On the Trail of UFOs, which is on Prime and Vimeo, I recommend checking it out if you can. Personally speaking, I've been diving into YouTube to rewatch the classic 1990s paranormal show Sightings, which has given me more than my fair share of chuckles, and also seen a couple of people that I've interviewed on the show in the 1990s sporting some rather marvellous moustaches, not mentioning any names, Malcolm Robinson. So if you haven't seen them, I recommend checking out Sightings on YouTube if you want to really take a trip down memory lane and see what paranormal television in the mid-1990s was like. Don't forget, you can leave us a nice review on your podcast app. And we've had such just a great response from the last show with Chrissy. So hello to all our new listeners. And we've got some great shows coming up in the next few weeks. A couple of really good Bigfoot episodes coming up, so I hope you like those. Don't forget, you can support the show via PayPal by making a donation for Searching for Mystery Monsters. The social media pages are on Facebook, and we're also on Instagram and Twitter as Mystery Monsters. And don't forget, you can always drop us a line via email at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com if you've any feedback or you want to come on the show. Other than that, the only thing I will say is, make sure you keep listening after I finish talking with Derek on the interview. Derek's kindly supplied us a bit of a surprise for anybody that's not heard Monsters Among Us, and it's one of my favourite calls into that particular show. Stay safe, take care, and here's Derek Hayes. This week, I am delighted to be joined by the host of one of my very favourite podcasts, Monsters Among Us, Derek Hayes. With the show recently celebrating its fourth birthday, Derek has continued to push the show to new levels, as well as recently starting to appear on Paranormal Caught on Camera, which has finally started airing in the UK and Europe, as well as preparing to film his new documentary, Shadows in the Desert, with David Flores from Blurry Photos. Derek previously worked in the film industry for 10 years and has had a passion for cryptozoology since he was 10 years old. Derek, I am finally delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate you having me on. I've been waiting for this call for a while. I'll be honest.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for wanting to come on. That's always that's something I always take great pride in when someone I respect and have listened to for such a long time wants to have a chat with me. I find it deeply honouring. So thank you for making time in your hectic schedule for me, sir.
Not a problem. Not a problem. I hope I live up to your standards.
I'm sure you will.
Setting a high bar there.
I'm sure I will. As I touched on there, Derek, obviously I'm a regular listener to your wonderful Monsters Among Us. But so I'm fully aware of how this wonderful world of the wheel weird kind of pulled you in when you were 10. So for anybody who's not a listener of Monsters Among Us, which I find hard to believe going on your listening figures,
there's a lot still out there, believe it or not.
We'll track
I'm still
down.
Looking for those people.
What was it that dragged you into this, Derek? How did you get your thirst for this subject?
Well, I'll tell you what, I found a rabbit hole and then I just fell completely down into it. When I was about 10 years old, I grew up on a small farm, I guess, like a hobby farm, I guess you would call it, in southeast Ohio. And for those listening abroad, that's in the Midwest in Ohio. It's kind of Appalachia is kind of where I grew up. It wasn't so much the Midwest. Anyway, we were my brother and friend and I were kind of messing around in this wooded lot. I mean, this is like a couple square miles of woods behind our house. Like there's nobody back there. And so we're kind of back there exploring. We're young. They're probably 8, and I think I was around 10 at the time. And at a certain point, we sit down on this large rock, and we decide we're going to eat the lunch that we packed with us. We really thought we were on quite the adventure. In reality, we're probably 500 yards from the house. So anyway, we're back here. We're eating, and all of a sudden, we hear some ruckus up on the hillside. And it wasn't like a – I think I've described it in the past as like a huge brush – you know, the brush like erupting or something. It wasn't that. It was just a couple sticks snapping. You could tell there was a large animal on the hillside. So we look up and sure as day there is, and you guys in the UK are going to know what this is. There was a big black cat. And I'm talking a leopard sized black cat. And this thing was freaked out that we were there. It ran full speed from our right to our left into an open clearing. We tried to cut it off, but it was so fast we couldn't even see it. So all three of us got a good look at this thing. We all described the exact same thing. And of course, I'm super excited. I want to go home and tell my dad about it. So we go home, wait for him to get off work. I wait. And finally, he shows up and I tell him the story. I'm like, oh, you won't believe what we saw. And he kind of looks at me deadpan. He's like, oh, yeah, I saw that thing last week. And my initial response was, and I say this every time I tell the story, but I have to. Why did he let us down in the forest, in the woods? If he knew that something like that was down there, he'd seen it himself. This thing could have taken one of us down if it wanted to.
Yeah.
I don't think it had any intention of doing anything similar to that, but it could have. So from that point on, you know, I went back to school. That happened during the summer, so I couldn't wait to get back to school, get to the library, and started finding, like, Daniel Cohen books and In Search Of, you know, documentaries and stuff like that, and it was just a rabbit hole from there. And ever since, I've been extremely interested in anything strange, anything odd that extends to, like, vampire hunting kits and stuff like that. But I mean, anything strange and unusual, I'm pretty into it. But the paranormal is my bread and butter.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing about Monsters Among Us, Derek, that's always struck me before you appeared on the podcast radar, was that I cannot believe that someone had never thought, why don't we do a call-in show for people who have had an experience, who you've basically become like a sort of virtual soundboard or agony aunt, as we call them in the UK, for anybody that's had a spooky experience in a variety of different topics and fields. So what was the germination process for that? Where did that spark come from that you thought, I mean, it is one of those amazing things that, when now you do it, it seems like the most obvious idea for a show. No offense taken, Derek.
No, not at all. I completely agree.
I just find it, and you know, all kudos to you for being that person that sort of caught that lightning in that bottle and ran with it.
Well, like I said, I like to do weird things, so I always have to have a hobby. I built a camper, like a little, or you guys call them a caravan.
Yes.
It's just like a little wooden camper that Sarah, my wife, and I, we hit up all the national parks in California and stuff with. And so it took me 6 months to make that in my garage. So I'm listening to podcast after podcast, and 99% of them were paranormal podcasts because that's what I love. So I'm soaking in all this information and listening to people give their firsthand accounts on different shows. And I'm not going to call anybody out because there's a space for everything.
Yeah.
But some of these guests would just go on and on and on and on. I'm thinking there's got to be a faster way to wrap this up. Like, I want to hear the story, but I don't want them to talk for 45 minutes. So yeah. I was thinking, how can I get everybody's firsthand account from their words and still be able to do it in like a 5 minute time span. And I just stumbled upon a way to actually submit these kind of stories, and you get the 5 minute voicemail. Back in the day, that was harder to find than it is now. So I just kind of ran with it. I honestly thought that I would get a handful of friends to chip in and maybe a few distant friends, and that would be the extent of it. But by the end of my first season, I had tons of listeners, and this thing kind of took off.
It did seem to snowball, because I know you've touched on this when you've spoken about those early days. Was that, you know, the first few episodes you were basically worrying about running out of calls.
Oh, yeah.
And things like that. And I think it was just the format was just such an enticing thing. As I said to you before we started our official chat, I'd obviously staggered across you, because obviously by that point I was a regular listener to Into the Fray. And you were on back in the days. What was the original name of the show, Derek?
Here There Be Monsters.
That's it. And then obviously there was another show. So I've been there from that very one, because I thought this chap sounds really interesting. Shannon clearly thinks a lot of him. That's why she's speaking to him. So
I love Shannon. She's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, she's the level we all aspire to, I suspect.
Yes.
And from that point on, like I've jokingly said that Shannon's basically a gateway podcast drug. That she's introduced me to so many people and essentially people I've built friendships with since I've heard them on there, and I would say that with regards to Shannon as well. So
yeah, I was actually just texting with her right before we got on here. Ironically enough, we're trying to figure out some sort of video conferencing thing, and I'm like, I know who's gonna know this. Shannon's gonna know, and of course she did.
Yeah. Strangely enough, I jumped on one of her live video conferences on Saturday night as well.
Oh, she's talked me into doing one tomorrow, but. This will already have aired by the time that happened.
Yeah, it was really good. All I'll say is the one I joined in, I didn't want to. Somebody joined in, and I've seen them so many times online and everything. I didn't realize they were a lady, to my shame. And then they appeared, and I went,
"That's unfortunate.
That's not who I thought you'd look like." But it was nice.
Yeah, it's weird with the screen names, isn't it? Sometimes you're not real sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So from that point on. What point did you think, I think this is catching fire?
Well, I'm a pessimist, I'll be honest. So about 6 weeks ago, maybe 6 months ago, it really hasn't been that long. I've been doing this for a living for about, well, I'll give you a brief background of what I've been doing. I worked in the film industry for 10 years in Los Angeles and kind of got burned out on it. I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So I started the show, and I was doing art on the side. I mentioned vampire hunting kits. I was doing stuff like that and cryptid replications and just oddball art that I was doing and selling. That's what I did for a living for a year and a half while I was still building up the show. And at a certain point, you know, the Patreon money started coming in, and then advertising money came in a little bit. And I said, well, you know, let's just make this a full-time gig. So luckily, Sarah does pretty well for herself, so I'm able to push this thing as far as it'll go. And I think big things are about to come in the next 6 to 12 months, as long as we survive everything that's going on.
Yeah, well, if there's any reason to get into podcasts, I would suggest being sat at home 24 hours a day. It's an opportunity for us to spread the word, I think, Derek.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, we are one of the few businesses, I think, that might thrive by, you know, all this stuff happening.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, somebody already said to me, are you going to do a show on what's going on? And I just went, no. I think I want to do shows not about what's going on, primarily because it's just everywhere at the minute.
That's true. It's nice to find an escape.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm trying to extend that to my show as well. If you listened to last week, I gave it like three lines, and then that was it. I'm moving on, because people came to get scared, and they're already scared. So let's find a different way to do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I completely agree. So I know you touched on there about your start in the film industry, Derek. So I assume you were working in sort of special effects and prop design.
Weirdly enough, no.
Oh.
That wasn't really something I even knew how to do. And it was just an accident. I made a birthday gift, and then everybody loved it so much. We're like, well, let's try to sell these. And I put them online, and next thing I know, I sold dozens of them. So But the film thing, you know, I grew up loving film. I shot horror movies as a kid with, you know, the camcorder, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Put my brothers in fake blood and threw them in the woods. I was always doing something like that.
Mm.
So film had to be or some sort of entertainment, I guess I should say. So we had moved to L.A. and I was, you know, I moved to L.A. in I think August of 2008, and the big crash happened like a week later. So it was a struggle for the first 5 or so years that I was here. So I did a lot of PA jobs, which is like an assistant on productions and office work. And then I eventually worked my way up to director of production at a medium-sized production company. We did movies like Underworld, Lincoln Lawyer, The Boy, if you're familiar with
yes.
The Boy. They just did the sequel recently.
Mm.
So yeah, that's some of the films that I worked on. I worked on some of the later – I didn't work on the first two Underworld films, but I worked on the other ones.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, very very well known. I've got a friend of mine who's obsessed with those films, though I suspect it's more his obsession with Kate Beckinsale than anything.
I think that drives a lot of people to watch those films.
Yeah, and maybe even Michael Sheen for other people as well. So
he is a splendid gentleman, by the way. I love Michael.
Yeah, he's a cult favourite over here in the UK, a multi-talented man and seems to be a damn fine chap to boot as well.
I had the privilege of meeting him several times, and he was a very nice man.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting because I've got a couple of friends who work in the film industry. So I fully understand just how full on it is, because I think for a lot of people, Derek, outside of it, it's one of those dream jobs.
Yeah, until you get into it.
And then it's basically 20-hour days and living on coffee.
And disappointment, yeah. Basically, that's all you have to fuel your life is, you know, long hours and disappointment. But sometimes there's rewarding things. Like if I didn't do all that, if I didn't take that journey, I never would have found the show and I never would have, you know, got into this. And actually, knowing how to edit a podcast comes from my days in film school, knowing how to edit a film. So this was a seamless transfer for me. So that made things a lot easier. I could focus on the scary part and not so much like the production part of it.
Absolutely. I mean, there is for me. Derek, my main source of entertainment these days is listening to podcasts. And like I say, every week I always look out for, you know, Thursdays I'm like, woo, it's Monsters Among Us day, and you know, Friday it's Into the Fray and things like that. So I kind of have my routines now. So for you, I mean, the one thing that's always struck me, and I've mentioned him a couple of times, alongside Ryan Sprague, Somewhere in the Skies, I'm just blown away by the level of work and care and production that you put into each episode. Because as the show has developed, I think the format has also developed, where you've gone from letting people talk about things and then you kind of give a little bit of an outline to the fact that now you're sort of researching calls based on what the people are telling us.
Yeah, you know, I try to make this a learning experience for people. I don't want this just to be the place to find scary stories. I want people to come here and learn about cryptozoology, learn about the paranormal, the history of the paranormal, the characters that are involved, which I'm trying to get a little more into now.
Mm.
It doesn't have to just be, you know, the one-off stories. And that's the other thing, too. A lot of these stories that I'm receiving compare to others, compare to dozens of others, compare to some very famous sightings. You know, if I get an alien abduction that's similar to the Betty and Barney Hill experience, then I'm certainly going to make that correlation. And I'm going to share as much information as I can about Betty and Barney Hill and do it in an interesting way that's typically not me saying it. I found that that's the most interesting way to deliver information is me not saying it.
No, but it's good though, because you know, especially for a non-native of the United States. I love listening to stories from around the country, because essentially, you know, I my knowledge of the United States is probably slightly higher than the average non-American, primarily because I love NFL. And I love Bigfoot, so I'm pretty au fait with certain states and things.
So you're a redneck, is what you're saying. Welcome to the club, man.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've wasted too many, especially the team. I'm for my sins. Washington are my NFL team.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I remember those heady days of having hair and Super Bowl wins, Derek.
Yeah, well, I'm a Cincinnati Bengals fan, so we haven't won a playoff game since 1991. So, I feel you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. Group hug, and we'll move on.
I'm ashamed that I admit that on your show here. I shouldn't have said that. Sorry.
Hey, that's okay. I'm in no position to pick you up on your choice of NFL team, sir, right now, and I haven't been for quite a long time. So, I just love it though, because it gives me a real insight into the traditions and the folklore of certain states that, you know, that perhaps 5 years ago I wasn't aware of any kind of spooky history. But I think we all fall into that kind of category when we look at phenomena in other countries, Derek.
Yeah, you know, that's actually why I started doing my season finales, which I call the hometown legend episodes,
yeah.
Which basically I want people to call in about whatever town they live in. Like, what are the legends from that town? You know, what are the urban legends, the scary stories, the rumors, the scary old house on the end of the block? Like, tell me what's happening in your neck of the woods, because I don't get to travel all over. I don't get to travel much at all, honestly, because I'm stuck down here in my studio. But I want to hear those stories just like you. I want to hear stories from places I haven't been and places I haven't gone to yet. And that's the perfect way to do it. I hear stuff from all over, and we're starting to get stuff from overseas finally. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah. I mean, that is the really good thing. I mean, cause it's very easy for, you know, for example, a British person, you know, we've all heard about Gettysburg, and we all know about Roswell, and we all know about Bigfoot. But there are so many wonderful stories. I mean, like, I'd never, you know, if you'd have asked me 5 years ago, I didn't know what the Pope Lick Monster was. I'd never heard of it, or the number of goat men sightings around there. But I think your show particularly shone a light, ironically, on a particular phenomenon, which I often find it odd that certain podcasts end up becoming associated with a particular type of phenomena. And for you guys, it's the Mirrored Men.
It is, yeah. And I find it as odd as you do. I know there's a couple other ones that have kind of uncovered their own kind of phenomena. And it's, if I was looking at this from the outside, I'll be honest, I'd be super skeptical of this. You know, if I was listening to Monsters Among Us and suddenly this weird phenomena came up, I would be super skeptical. But I promise everybody, these calls are coming in. I didn't create any of these calls. So essentially, do you want me to tell what these things are?
Yeah, please. Dive into it, my friend.
Sure. Well, essentially, the calls I started getting were, it started with a friend of mine, to be honest with you. He told me a story in college, and you mentioned it earlier, early on in the show, I was having a really hard time getting people to call in. I just didn't have the listeners. So I would hit up everybody I knew, like, oh, you told me a story once. Can you call that in and tell this? And they were so reluctant to do it. But luckily, my buddy Matt, he's like, yeah, I'll do it. And that story blew up. So essentially, what took place in that short submission was that my buddy Matt was asleep in his bed. He was in high school, I believe, lived at the end of a cul-de-sac in a developing neighborhood. They hadn't built most of the houses yet. And he was laying in bed, woke up suddenly, and had the urge to look outside. He said somebody was calling to him to look outside mentally. It wasn't a verbal call. So he goes outside, and there's three gentlemen standing in the street. And as they move, they all move in unison. Like, their movements are mirrored. And so he's watching these guys. They look really odd. And suddenly they all turn and kind of look at him as if they acknowledge that he, you know, is looking down at them. And that's when he realizes he misses several hours of time. Next thing he knows, it's daytime and he's still in that same position. So I thought that was a one-off story. You know, it's a strange, weird story. I thought maybe somebody's playing a joke and he fell asleep. I never really thought anything of it when he told me the story. And honestly, when I played it, I thought it was just another tale to, you know, get through another episode. And I got several other calls. And then over the years, I've had probably a dozen and a half submissions about this strange phenomena. And they all seem to describe the same thing. Sometimes they're dressed differently, but it's usually three men. I've heard maybe two calls where it was two men, but it's usually three. They move in unison. There's always missing time. It's just super freaky. And I don't have an explanation. I really wish I did. I just don't.
Yeah, because the thing is that there are two unique facets to this phenomenon for me. One is the fact that people feel compelled to find a way to look at something, or they look at a specific, you know, they're not looking at anything, and then all of a sudden they think, oh, and their glance changes and they're focused on a certain area, as your friend was, that he felt compelled to rise and look out of his window. But then the other aspect, as you say, is also the missing time. It's like two phenomenon with very different responses in people.
It is, yeah, and it's so hard to categorize what this could be. Is this a Hat Man situation? Is this a Shadow Man thing? Is this extraterrestrial, interdimensional, ghostly? Who knows what this phenomenon actually is? So, with each report we get, it sounds cliche, but we're left with more answers than or questions than answers because a new clue will be dropped on the table. I'm like, well, where do I put this thing? You know, it's. Instead of missing time, they're missing a whole day or something. Like, how do you apply that to these stories that already exist? And we're starting to see the blueprint of what these encounters are. But again, we have no clue what they are. We just see the pattern that's developing.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense, my rambling.
No, I understand. And for me, the other aspect of it is that you can't sort of lump it in with Men in Black sightings because... It from certainly from the calls I've heard on the show and listened to, my general interpretation is that these people have never had any kind of paranormal experience prior to this event. Whereas obviously Men in Black are uniquely and consistently associated with UFO witnesses.
That's true, yeah. But they do seem to behave similarly.
Yes.
The description seems similar. The odd movements seem similar. So maybe they're a different division. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that they remind me of, the mirrored men, in the way they're kind of strange, that they see some witnesses describe them as moving kind of robotically as well, is that there's a very famous Men in Black case where a man and a woman, one of the rare ones featuring a female in black, and they basically... come into somebody's house and it's as though one of them breaks down. I'm not sure if you've heard that particular story, but
it sounds familiar. Yeah.
And it was, I think the witness described it as almost as if she'd short circuited and things, she wasn't able to keep up the pretense anymore.
That sounds vaguely familiar. Is that the same one where the gentleman said, I'll ask for a glass of water in 20 minutes?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I do remember this story.
Yeah, I think it's one of those Fortean classics that keeps popping up again. And there is that weird aspect, because that in the Men in Black phenomena is quite peculiar, primarily because we've got a female involved, which is very rarely mentioned. And also the fact that they seem to go a bit odd.
Yeah, yeah, it's almost like they've been studying us from afar, and they're trying to mimic our behaviors, and they just simply can't they can't manage all of them, and they're it also seems like they're battling our elements or something. You mentioned that she broke down. I've seen other ones that parts of their face seem to be melting or something. Like they're just battling the heat of our atmospheres. It just however the weather is that day, it's just not. They're not accustomed to that. It just the whole thing just seems strange.
Yeah.
John Keel does tons of case files and stuff on different Men in Black oddities, and that's one of my or some of my favorite. How should I say this? Some of my favorite reports come from Keel.
Yeah, I mean Keel was a very diligent investigator, and I think he was a precursor to certain individuals such as Linda Godfrey that. When they've come forwards, and I've heard this from several people involved in investigating a particular phenomenon, that they'll tend to get more reports about different things. And Keel's a prime example, because Keel will forever be linked with Mothman.
Yeah.
But when you read the Mothman prophecies, the Mothman is quite a small part
of
that.
Yeah, he hardly shows up in the entire book. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's weird how that's become... remarkably memorable when it's probably the least recorded paranormal event throughout that 30 months he was in Point Pleasant.
It's true. I never really looked at it that way. I'm sure we look at the experiences, of Scarberry's and Mallet's, I think, were the original witnesses in Point Pleasant. You look at their experience, and it's just so phenomenal. It's so film-esque. It's movie-esque that it just sticks with people. It sticks in people's heads, and that's the first thing they go to. You hear Mothman, you can visualize that first experience that they had in the 57 Chevy driving away from the TNT area. So I can see why people would flock to the Mothman, but you're 100% correct. There was so much weird activity going on there, and he wrote about all of it to great lengths and barely mentioned anything of the Mothman throughout the entire book. I mean, he obviously was mentioned, but it pales in comparison to other stuff. It's just strange. But it also tells you how much stuff was actually going on in and around Point Pleasant at that time. Like, it just, if half of what he wrote was true, then that's incredible.
It just seemed to cover the whole gamut, and it seems to be one of those wonderful little areas that essentially we now call them window areas, mm-hmm. where there's just seem a whole plethora of phenomena across everything, because there they had men in black turning up, strange lights in the sky, poltergeist activity, weird people hanging around the street, strange phone calls. I think one of my favourite aspects of that was these like little pockets on roads where basically you, as soon as you stepped into it, you were overcome with a terrifying fear, as though you were entering an emotional bubble.
And of course, don't forget about Indrid Cold and Woody Derenberger.
Yes,
going on as well.
Well, obviously. Yeah.
So much weird stuff. I mean, it's a window area. That's the best way to describe it.
Yeah. I mean, Indrid's a very interesting thing, because obviously he's sort of kind of caught the zeitgeist associated with obviously the Hellier explosion over the last few months, because obviously Indrid's mentioned in that. And I think it's interesting to see how it's one of those assumptions we often make. Like you say, I think once you do a deep dive into something like Keel, Indrid Cole's one of those people you know about him, and you know about his strange gaunt looks and his grinning face. So it was really interesting to see just how many people who were interested in the paranormal weren't aware of who Indrid Cold was.
There's a ton of these stories too, and we're starting to unravel them. There's people like Seth Breedlove out there, and obviously Shannon recently with In the Trail of UFOs. People are getting out there and researching this stuff, and we're uncovering all these new stories that have been buried for years. So it's pretty exciting, the other stuff that we may dig up that we just weren't aware of.
Yeah. Like, as you touched on, is there any other kind of strange phenomenon? I mean, because obviously when people ring you in, I think that one of the delightful aspects of your show is you don't focus on one particular aspect of the paranormal or the Fortean. You basically cover UFOs, aliens, ghosts, poltergeists, precognition. We've got strange cryptids wandering around. I mean, recently you've had a couple of, I mean, this is another aspect that I always find, people who see pterodactyls or pteranodons.
It's very true, and I've got so many of those recently. I have three or four still in the bank that I have to pepper in. But yeah, I've received a lot of these pterodactyl calls, and I was actually talking to my dad, man, I don't remember when this was, maybe around Thanksgiving or something, and I'd never heard this story. If I had, I'd never remembered it, but I happened to play a call. My dad's a big listener to the show, and I happened to play a pterodactyl call, and he called me like a week later. He's like, you know, I saw one of those too, right? And I'm like, what are you talking about? So he told me the story, and I'm pretty sure I shared it on the show a couple of weeks later. But it's just weird. Like, obviously, we don't think there's pterodactyls flying around, but people are clearly seeing something that they're confusing. Like, I know how my dad was raised, and I've been with him, in the woods and stuff, and he's not going to mistake a turkey or a vulture or something like that for a pterodactyl. It's not going to happen. He's not going to do that, at least. I can't say that for people I don't know, but so that leaves me with at least one shred of doubt that he saw something strange that made him think it wasn't a regular bird. So what exactly was it?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting as well, because obviously, as you mentioned, Seth Breedlove there, their film last year, Terror from the Skies, and obviously I know Ken Gerhardt's done work on this particular subject before, so I was quite aware of the whole, you know, pterodactyl, pteranodon phenomena, especially with it going hand in hand with obviously the stories of a giant eagle and such birds and the thunderbird phenomenon. It's for me, I'm would not be surprised, Derek, if there is a giant throwback or occasional blips in the lineage of creatures like an eagle, where occasionally there might be one that turns up that has a genetic throwback to a far off time. But these flying dinosaur stories, I just find incredible, as I do with anybody who claims to have witnessed any form of dinosaur, because we simply know that there's no possibility, as far as we're aware and we're taught, that they're anywhere other than, you know, what we've got, you know, that we call crocodiles, and the Komodo dragon is a prime example of a of something that's still munching around exactly the same as it used to, obviously a bit smaller, because they're bad enough as they are. I wouldn't like to see how they used to look. So, I mean, it is, how do you balance that? Because, like you say, they should not be there. There is no possibility, yet your own father saw one.
It's super difficult. It really is. And I struggle with that with the show. Like, I'll get a call and let's say it's a pterodactyl call, and I'll think to myself, there's no way there's pterodactyls flying. Like, I'm too rational of a person to believe that they survived and we just don't know about it. So what else could it be? A ghost? You know, people have thrown the theory out there that maybe these are the ghost of pterodactyls. So it could possibly be, you know, a spirit of one of these creatures, but I find that very hard to swallow as well. Mm-hmm. So we're left with, you know, more questions. And you mentioned that, you know, a throwback to like a giant eagle or something like that. We do know those exist. I don't have the name in front of me, but there was recently an article about a Neanderthal child that was found with talon marks in its skull. Yeah. And they figured out which bird it was. It was some extinct bird that was like a 16, 20 foot wingspan eagle. Yeah. Basically it swooped down, picked up this kid and unfortunately ate it. So there's precedent for that kind of thing. It's just how do you explain it? How do you rationalize it? Yeah. But that's kind of the beauty of the show too, is I'm not afraid to play stuff like that I can't explain. I think we learn more that way, and I find it much more terrifying if I can't explain something. If somebody calls in and says, I saw the chupacabra in Texas, I'm like, well, it's probably a coyote with some sort of skin disorder. But if you call in and say you saw a large bipedal creature that looked you dead in the eye and you saw footprints, that's a lot harder to explain.
Yeah Very much so. I mean, as you touched on there, the one thing about the paranormal that I've always been perplexed by is, if we assume, let's work on the principle that ghosts are the spirits of the departed, why we have so few reports of ghost animals? Because
it's a good question.
I know people that have had experiences with ghosts of dogs and cats, where they've lost a pet and then they can still hear them moving about, or there's certain anybody who's owned a pet knows that their animal usually has, you know, certain telltale sounds, or they behave in a certain way, or they, you just know when they're about, if you know what I mean, even if they're not in the same room as you.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally we'll get stories of people riding horses who are, you know, dressed in old-fashioned clothes, who are clearly people out of time. So I've always been very surprised that we don't get more. But then again, it depends if you own a pet or not. Because if you're outside and you see a cow, you assume it's a cow. You don't think, is that actually a cow or a ghost? And it's only when you have that kind of interaction in an environment where you know there isn't an animal. So I'm always intrigued that we don't get more of them. But maybe it's that dismissal because they're expected to be where people sometimes see them.
Well, it's almost like the whole Walmart theory, that if you saw a ghost in Walmart, you wouldn't know you saw a ghost because you expect people to be in there. You know, the pet thing's kind of the same way, and it's a good point I've never really thought of, but you're exactly right. If I saw a cat in my yard, I would just think there was a cat in my yard. I wouldn't think it was a ghost. But if I saw a woman in a Victorian dress in my yard, well, I might change my mind, you know. That shouldn't be there. But a cat, I can understand. Like, that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've heard that, especially when it comes to things like Nessie and Champ, I've seen that theory put forward, that people are actually seeing ghosts of dinosaurs.
The problem I have with that is that the lock is only, I'm going to get the name or the number wrong, but hundreds of thousands of years old, and there hasn't been a you know, aquatic reptile dinosaur type creature there in 65 million years. So. Yes. And the lake wasn't even there then. So there's little things like that you really have to, like, take into account when looking at things like, well, especially Loch Ness. There's a lot of issues. I hate to bring down one of your European.
It's okay. I'm probably of the same opinion.
I just think that, I think Loch Ness is a tall order because it's had so much scrutiny and really nothing has been put forth. And what has, most of it's been regarded as a hoax. So it's difficult to kind of buy into that. But you have other places like Okanagan and Lake Champlain and Lake Van in Turkey. Like, these places are a little more interesting and anything's possible. And of course, there's always the theory too that's been floating around forever that there was something in Loch Ness and it's now deceased.
Absolutely, yeah. Loch Ness is a strange one. As someone, it's obviously a go-to zone if you love anything weird in the UK, and it's somewhere I've visited. And aside from the monster, it is one of the most beautiful parts of the United Kingdom. It's a stunning place.
I can't wait to go there.
Oh, it's incredible. If you're lucky enough that the sun's shining, I went there during a very rare heat wave in Scotland. No offence, Scotland. I'm sure they'll understand what I mean. But it was absolutely red hot, and it was crystal clear, and I spent 3 or 4 days around Loch Ness. It's absolutely stunning, and there's other little things around it that people like. There's a petrified forest that's been there thousands of years, which if you go looking for the monster, you're kind of surprised to discover that there's this other wonderful piece of history just around the corner from it, and an old castle and things like that. So yeah, Loch Ness is one of those, out of all the lake monsters, I've said this before, probably to my fellow citizens' disappointment and disapproval, Derek, that Loch Ness is probably the one I least expect to find a giant creature of any kind in, whereas the others, Champ especially, I'm wouldn't be surprised if there's something very large swimming about down there.
It's an easier pill to swallow, isn't it, when you don't have the restrictions that Loch Ness has. I'd love to be wrong. I of course do not want to be right on trying to debunk any of this stuff, but I think it's important for us to be rational and look at things with a rational mind. It can't all be magic. Some of the stuff has to be fake. So we just have to figure out what's fake and what's not real, and then start weeding that out. And what we're left with is the real mystery. And that's what I'm looking for.
I mean, I always found it really odd at the beginning of the show, because when it first started, the one thing I've always liked is whenever you've discussed someone's call or experience, you've always gone at it in a very balanced way, Derek, because I think sometimes it's very easy to go either way. You know, you either dismiss it and say, you know, Mothman's a prime example. Yeah, he just saw a sandhill crane. Or you go the other way and you go full on, yes, it's clearly paranormal. Yes, this proves everything. And what I found peculiar was some of the criticism you received in regards to the way you dealt with these calls, because I thought you were being exceptionally fair with some of them, because some of them were really, you know, some of the calls you get are subjects where, you know, as we've touched on, it really does push the boundaries of credulity, but you give the person the respect they deserve by letting them have this platform.
Yeah, I think it was something that was difficult for people to kind of get behind at first in regards to me, like, not criticizing, but questioning the events that are being described. I'm trying to be careful about how I word this. I've experienced things. I've seen a full-bodied apparition once. I saw the black cat. I think that's my brother and I have been talking back and forth about a possible UFO we saw, but I think it might have been a Goodyear blimp that got loose. We're trying to find some news articles to kind of compare notes. But I've had those experiences. So I don't want to call somebody and share that story with them and have them tell me flat out, well, that didn't happen. I mean, that's incredibly rude. But I think it's also incredibly rude that if you see there's a logical explanation here and you tell them, and you don't tell them what that explanation is, I think that's rude as well, because some of these people are looking for help. Some of these people are looking for answers. And if you tell them, oh, well, what the thing that's terrifying you right now is actually dust that's picked up by your IR lens and your camera.
Yeah.
And then they can sleep at night. Other people get kind of mad about that. They're like, well, I've had this story for 20 years. This is the story. I'm like, well, I'm just, you know, offering up other options, other plausible explanations to what this may be. It doesn't all have to be paranormal. But at the end of the day, I'd leave it as open as possible and let the listener decide what they think to each call.
Yeah.
Because my opinion doesn't matter. Other people's opinion doesn't matter. It's what you think. So I try to present as much information. If I see a possible explanation, I'm going to throw it out there. Of course, I'm not going to say 100% that's what it is. I'm going to say that's more likely than it being an alien, but I wasn't there.
Yes.
That's my favorite out. I wasn't there.
Well, it's a good place to be, Derek, because I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that I've kept coming back to the show is that balance that you bring to the calls, because I think people understand, as naff as this may sound, it's a paranormal safe space for people.
Yeah, yeah. I do my best to make it that in multiple different levels. Mm. We have, if you listen to the call or listen to the show, we have so many different types of people that call in. We have truckers. We have I've had doctors call in, pilots. I've had all kinds of different people from all different walks of life. And if you know anything about the U.S., you can't get people to do anything together. They're separated down the line on literally everything. So if I can get everybody to come in and share these stories, regardless of political affiliation or race or any of that stuff, like, I don't care about any of that. I want your story. I want you to share your story, and I want people to listen. So, you know, I try my best to try to accommodate to everybody and make it as safe as possible without criticism, without judgment, and with as much information as I can deliver in 5 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is one of those wonderful shows, like I say.
Thank you.
Because there's been a couple of times I've listened to stories and the hairs on the back of my neck have stood up and I've felt a little bit creepy. And I consider myself, as you say, I'm not dismissive of anybody. There are certain subjects in this field that I'm a little less open to. However,
you have to be.
I have experienced things as you touch on there. So I'm not completely dismissive. However, I am critical, and I've seen enough bad investigation in all fields to judge things in a similar way to yourself, Derek, that I've seen things I can't explain. Therefore, I'm not going to dismiss anybody else's experience, regardless of the subject, out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No matter how off the wall the submission is, you know, who knows what that person actually saw? It may be just in their head, but they still, you know, they hallucinated it. They still saw it, and it's still affecting them. So just letting them talk about it, letting them share that experience and get it out there with other people, that seems to be helping people a lot as well. And that's kind of a very fortunate side effect. I had no intention of this being like paranormal psychology or anything like that, or therapy. That's what people call it, paranormal therapy. Yeah. I had no intention of that, but that's just a fortunate side effect of the way this was all set up.
Yeah. So do you remember the first time you had a call sent to the show that made you feel a little uncomfortable?
Oh, man. The first time, there's been several times, but the first time, it might have been the Painted Man. I believe it's from Allen in Arizona.
Mm.
The short story is he was coming back from some sort of race in Arizona, and he was in the high part near the Grand Canyon, I believe, Flagstaff area. I might be wrong on that. But anyway, he's driving down the road, and he's fallen asleep. And as he wakes up, he looks, and there's a man running along the side of his truck going 60 miles an hour, 70 miles an hour, painted, striped. He was gray with, I think, orange stripes or something along those lines. And he would run and keep up with the truck. And of course, the guy would freak out, hit the gas, and take off. And a few miles later, he would he'd kind of doze off again and wake up, and there'd be the guy running along the truck again. I guess that happened a couple times, and he finally made it home. Mm. Well, he thought that was strange. And then years later, he was in the Army and was actually stationed out here by me and talking to his roommate, who oddly enough was from the same area. And he's telling this roommate the story, and the exact same thing and the exact same stretch of road happened to the roommate. So when I heard the first part was freaky, the second part, that's when I got the chills. And I think that was a season four, maybe late season three, something like that. That's when, no offense to the earlier calls, but that's when the really juicy stuff started coming in. I started getting a wider net, and I could pull some like these really spooky stories. Try that again. I could pull some of these really spooky stories out. So, Yeah, that was one of the first ones. It's one of my favorites to this day still.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm all in on that one because I remember when I heard that one, and it was a particularly dark and stormy night in the UK, and the rain was pounding. And I always listen to your show. I tend to listen to podcasts late at night, which, given the subject matter, can sometimes surprise people. And that was probably the first call I'd heard on your show that made me check the doors a little more when I went to bed, double check the windows were shut, even though it had nothing to do with seeing anything in your own home. Really did bring my hackles up, that one.
There was just something unsettling about it, and I don't know exactly what it is, but you know, there's the legends of that area. The Native Americans in that area had skinwalkers, and there's a few other legends that I need to research before I talk on them. But so that could account for this kind of activity. And for me, anytime you bring in like Native American legend or something, it just makes it magical for me. Like, it gives it like a hint that it might be real, you know, just because they've been talking about it for hundreds of thousands of years. That speaks a little to me. I mean, there's a reason they keep talking about it. Is that reason because it's important to their culture, or is that reason because it's real?
Yeah, very much so. Absolutely. I mean, there is one of the aspects of certain Native American stories that have transcended into American culture. Bigfoot is probably the
prime example.
Yeah. Thunderbird is another one. But
Ogopogo is another one.
Yeah. So I've said this to a few people. I always find it really odd when cave art and certain, you know, and Australia, the Aborigines, I'm sure people will be sick of me making this comparison. But I just find it odd that we find these beautiful thousands of years old pieces of art on caves and walls, Derek. And there'll be like a bison or a big snake or a, you know, bears and things, and then next to it there'll be Bigfoot or a Thunderbird, and they'll go, well, they're all real, but those two are clearly dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, how does that work?
You know, it's I'm not clever enough to come up with a word for this, and I'm sure it exists, but it's kind of the opposite version of a skeptic. When you believe too much or you're too skeptical, it's the same problem. You're not open-minded enough to realize that obviously these six animals are real animals we know, and then there's just one painted exactly the same style, obviously the same person. Yeah. Why is this one the fake one? You're 100% right. And I think it's just narrow-mindedness, to be honest. It's easier to dismiss it than to actually do the work to find out if that's something that existed or still exists. And I can kind of further this on that I've been spending a lot of time in the desert here. I have an upcoming documentary, and part of what I'm doing is trying to find a lot of these petroglyphs and what's the other word where they etch it in? It's been a long week. Petroglyph and hieroglyph. No, not hieroglyph. Whatever. Yes. Somebody's out there screaming at me. But
yeah, me and you both.
So anyway, the desert's peppered with these things because it's the perfect environment to preserve them. So the few that I found, I've seen some really strange things. There's one in particular that I'd love to talk about that depicts, and I wish I had the picture in front of me, I could describe it better, but it depicts three or four celestial objects in the sky that are different colors. There's a green one, a red one, a blue one, and then obviously the sun, which is yellow. So what are these multicolored things in the sun? They look like they're the same shape that you would draw as a sun, but they're just different colors. So this is the kind of thing like I want to get to the bottom of. There's a couple other ones out there that show figures. There's a human looking figure, and then right next to it there's another human looking figure, but much more bulky, like they drew the shoulders bigger, and for some, why is this one different than the other one? Just these kind of questions you have to at least ask them. You don't have to necessarily believe them, but you have to at least ask these questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those cultural things, like dragons. Why have dragons been in our cultures for so long when people have not supposed to have this cross-pollination of culture? Because we're always told that our ancestors simply didn't know other countries existed other than certain hubs in the world, Derek. Yet, from China to Canada to South America to Africa, there are stories of dragons.
And pyramids.
Yeah.
I mean, each one of those continents have pyramids on them. I don't know about Africa, but South America, Southeast Asia, like you just kind of compare them to a lot of their architecture, compare them. Mm-hmm. Many people say, well, that's the most basic shape that's not going to fall down. That is true. But how did they all discover this roughly at the same time? Like, this isn't stuff I know a ton about, but these are questions I'm super interested in.
Yeah, I love that kind of melting pot of ideas from thousands of years ago, when you've got certain incredible civilizations all sort of rising up at the same time with zero contact. I just find it,
yeah,
it blows my mind.
I think it's also important to bring up, and people are guilty of this, and I've been guilty of this myself, that we got to still give credit where credit is due. These people still, it seems, built these things. And a lot of people are like, oh, aliens did it. And they're just taking away accomplishments from people thousands of years ago. They may be dead and gone, but we should still appreciate their work.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when you see certain things, I mean, I love it when somebody stumbles across a Mayan temple in the middle of a jungle somewhere.
I want to do that so bad. I want to be that person that just finds one.
Yeah. You know, nobody's seen it for 800 years. And you're just like, what? The world just amazes me every day. There's something gets found or appears. I mean, obviously, UK, we come across all sorts. And there's, you know, the Scandinavians keep finding Viking longships that nobody knew was there for 1,000 years, and it's just wonderful.
Well, we sort of had stuff like that growing up in Ohio. We have it's mound country.
Yeah.
So right around where I grew up, actually, there's several different mounds. We used to go to like field trips in elementary school and stuff to these things. And I remember growing up, and my dad would tell me stories about these, and we'd always be out looking for different mounds that haven't been discovered yet. Because when I was a kid, there was tons of land in Southeast Ohio that hadn't been farmed or logged or anything. It was just virgin land still. So you could go kind of look for that kind of thing. And there was a rumor. I'll go on a tangent real quick, but it seems like it's in line with what we're talking about. Mm. When my dad bought the property that he lives at now, I believe he bought it in like 1981 or something. I was very young. But anyway, when he moved in there, he discovered there was a really old guy that lived down the lane back behind the house. I mean, this is like miles, but it's the closest neighbor at the time. And he went back and talked to this guy. He was in his 90s. And he said when he moved there, there were still Native Americans living in the area, lived in like, I don't know what their structures were called, but we'll call them huts or whatever. They had their little villages. That's how long ago this guy moved there. Wow. In my head, the math doesn't work out, but I'm just telling the story that I heard. So anyway, this guy claimed that somewhere back behind my dad's property, which again is several square miles, there is a set of stairs made out of stone that goes up this hill that leads to this big mound. Mm. And we looked for years and years, and we never were able to find anything like that. But this guy claimed it was here. He'd been there dozens of times, and he said he'd take us to see it if he wasn't so old. But of course, and then he died very recently after that. So that's the story that my dad told me over and over again growing up. And I was always fascinated with that. That was my little slice of finding a Mayan temple in the Amazon.
Well, why not? Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. I've always found that a very intriguing part of American history, that there doesn't seem to be... I mean, I might be wrong, Derek, but my interpretation is it seems to be a very undervalued aspect of American history that I think only recently has started to see people properly investigate these mounds.
Yeah, they don't know a lot about them, from what I understand. Obviously, I haven't done a ton of research on this. This is speaking off of what I remember. But most of these cultures were around a long time before the Native Americans that were here when the Europeans started coming over. So there's a lot of mystery surrounding these cultures. You know, some of these mounds they build are in odd shapes. The one famous one in Ohio is a snake, and I think this thing's like half a mile long or something, and at the end of the snake it's eating an egg. So it's this huge massive structure. You can see it from the sky and everything. And that's another question people ask, is why are they building these structures that you can really only see from the sky? Like, what's the point? Like, who are they building these for? So you kind of got to ask those questions. And then when I don't want to get conspiracy theory here, but when you start looking at these older cultures like the Anasazi and these mound builders, they all seem to have these legends of star people.
Yes.
Which were these people that came down and kind of aided them and helped them learn different things like farming and building and that kind of thing. And all these stories are super vague. I don't know where they got these stories if they don't know anything else, but they know these stories. But these are all the things I'm regurgitating that I've heard over the years.
Yeah. I mean, is there anything you've learned since you've started doing the show, Derek, about, obviously, you, as you refer to, You grew up in rural Ohio. So is there anything that you've kind of come across since the show started over the last 4 years that you were unaware of that was an Ohio legend or a tale that it would seem you were surprised not to know about your home state?
Actually, yeah, and this happened very recently. It's funny you bring this question up because this is going to be on a show here either this week or next week. But I have a werewolf call or a dogman call from basically my hometown.
Oh.
And I want to play this so bad, but the quality on the call is so terrible. You can barely make out what's going on. So I've been trying to clean it up, but I've been reaching out to the person, trying to get them to resubmit. It doesn't look like it's going to happen, but the call is too cool not to share. Mm. So I did that in typical fashion. If there's a call that I'm interested in, that I think everybody else is going to be interested in, not that they're not all interesting, but there's some of them are more marquee than others. I do my research. I dig in. So I started digging in and I found that a small town, I think it's like 30 miles from where I went to college, has a werewolf legend. And during I won't give too many details because like I said, it's going to be in the show, but during like a couple week period in the 70s, like 6 or 7 different people saw this werewolf dogman type creature in this small town in northwest Ohio. So I'm pretty excited about that. I didn't know anything about it. So it's something I want to kind of dig into. I'm surprised Seth hasn't included in one of his films yet.
Obviously. I mean, I've I've touched on before, there are so many aspects to your show from callers up and down America and Canada, which I always love because, like I say, I've heard so many local legends and as you say, your season finales that you do every season is always usually a hometown legend, which I absolutely love. Were you surprised at how many you've got? Obviously last season you had to do a triple episode of them.
Yeah, I had to put the third one on Patreon. I just didn't want to flood them all out there. I'm not surprised because every town has one of these legends. Mm. Every place has one. Mine were boring growing up, but I still had them. Mm. Where I live now, there's several legends. I haven't even begun to share any of those yet. Mm. So yeah, I'm not all that surprised that the legends are out there. I am surprised that people participate. It's still to this day, I'm like, I can't believe these people are listening to this. I can't believe people are calling in and sharing this stuff and buying products. Like, it just blows my mind that people are so receptive of everything that we're putting out. But yeah, the hometown legends stories, I love those. I'll be honest, they're a lot more work than a regular episode, but they're so worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like a little guided tour of weird America. I love them.
Yeah, I think last season we did East versus West here in the U.S. and we did a vote on it. I'm pretty sure the East won, which didn't surprise me all that much.
Mm. Yeah, it's got a couple of big weapons in its arsenal, the East, when it comes down to freaky things.
Oh yeah, I mean Flatwoods, Mothman, Dover Demon, Hopkinsville Goblins, Loveland Frogman, like that's just right in that little area. So
yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Brilliant. So listen, you've touched on it a little bit. Now, obviously, you're about to dive into the world of documentaries with your collaboration with David Flores, Shadows in the Desert. Now, I must excuse my ignorance. I'm not overly familiar with the weird phenomenon of the area known as the Borrego Triangle. I think the only couple of stories I might be thinking the completely wrong area, Derek, so please correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
Is a story about a mysterious galleon or ship that's supposed to be out there somewhere, and people have spent hundreds of years trying to find this damn thing. And then
that is one of the legends. Yeah.
Thank goodness. And the other one is essentially a Bigfoot, which is known as the Borrego Sandman.
Yep, that's right. You got the accent and everything.
Oh.
Let me start by saying David Flora, not Flores.
Oh, sorry.
That way we get his name right. Hey, David.
Thanks, David. Sure, sorry, David.
Basically, you haven't heard of it because nobody's talking about this place. Mm. I'll do the long version of how I kind of got into this, and I'll try to make it short, though.
Okay.
Sarah and I do tons of camping. We're always out. Whenever we can, we try to get away, and the desert is one of those places. It's about a 2-hour drive from where I live now, something like that. So we'll go down to the biggest state park in California, which is Anza Borrego, and it's this vast desert. It's Beautiful and Deadly. So I've been going there for years, and I thought this place has to have some sort of ghostly legend. Like, there's an old stagecoach that runs through here, like an old train line. There's an old town, like old West towns, mining operations. Obviously, the Spanish galleon or the Viking ship. It depends on which story you believe. Yes. We can touch on that here in a bit. So anyway, I went in there and I started talking to some people. I was looking for books. I was looking for documentaries, and literally nothing existed. So I got home from our first trip there and I got online and started looking, and there was pretty much nothing there as well. But then I started uncovering all these reports that people are putting in, have put in through like BFRO and MUFON and some other these submission websites. And there's just so many of them in this area. So then we start doing a little bit of research. I dragged David in on this by this point. And so we're doing a little bit of research. I'm like, man, we're just uncovering tons of stuff from UFOs. You wouldn't believe the amount of UFO sightings that come out of there. People have seen glowing humanoids just walking through the desert. There's several different haunted places that are haunted by like a woman that died on a stagecoach. And there's a couple brothers that fought at a well and killed each other. Those ghosts still haunt the well. There's spook lights in the park that people have been reporting for years. And in fact, has actually caused a train derailment that killed a brakeman. I believe that was in 1974, 75, something like that. So they thought it was an oncoming train, and they were about to cross the world's largest wooden trestle, which is still standing down there, by the way. And it's ominous, and I can't wait to put that on film. So he saw the light coming from the other side. They thought it was an oncoming train. They locked up the brakes, it derailed and killed the brakeman. So once these things started piling up, I realized that it wasn't just that there was a lot of encounters here. It may be that this area may be one of these window areas. And because not a lot of people live there, and the people that do live there aren't the most vocal of people, if that's a way to say, you know, people live in the desert for a reason. And so I feel like a lot of this stuff just really hasn't been showcased. So David and I want to get in there and try to do it justice. We want to be professional about it. We want to be entertaining about it, more importantly. But we want to try to get to the bottom of it, get people to understand what we've uncovered, get people to get this on the radar, essentially, because right now it just isn't. And that's one of the frustrating things about the area I live. Like, we have millions and millions of people who live in the greater LA area, and there's just really not a lot of places like this with these kind of legends. Not like back east, anyway. So as far as the phenomenon taking place there, like I said, the UFOs, the glowing figures, Dog Man has been seen there, the ghost light. There's this creature known as the Borrego Sandman that you mentioned. And this is basically like a skinny, scrawny Bigfoot. He's said to have like a tan or almost a white color coat. And this thing's been seen for hundreds of years. The Spanish missionaries that came through California wrote reports of seeing and hearing natives talk about this creature. It ransacked ranches in the 1800s. There's several articles about people going on hunting parties trying to hunt these things down. And they were seen all the way up until like the late 80s, and then it just kind of died off. So we think maybe something happened to the population or something. That's another thing we kind of want to get to the bottom of. So I might be saying too much there, but there's just so much activity, and like I said, nobody's heard of it, and it's not the same regurgitated stuff over and over. So we thought people would really, you know, flock to this.
Yeah. Did it surprise you, Derek, once you started? Obviously, you know, you kind of thought, I'm surprised nobody's doing anything about this. But were you then surprised about how much you started to uncover about the phenomena?
A little bit, yeah. I didn't expect to find as much as we did. I knew the area was strange. I'd heard, I probably should have mentioned that. I'd heard rumors that the area had strange paranormal activity, but that's about the extent of it. Somebody would mention it in passing on a podcast, or I'd see it mentioned in a documentary. What's the name of that show? Mysteries at the Museum.
Yes.
Did a short segment on the Borrego Sandman, and that's one of the things that kind of put it on my radar before we went camping there. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but it's kind of...
Yeah, I mean, it is intriguing. Like I say, the most famous aspect of it is this infamous ship, of which there seems to be a couple of similar stories, but obviously they both can't be true.
Well, actually, they could both be true, I think. Again, this is a long story I'll try to tell short. There's a place called the Salton Sea that is pretty close to Anza Borrego. I think it's maybe 50 miles difference, but in southwest distance, that's nothing. That's a short drive.
Yeah.
So the Salton Sea was created, I want to say 1925. I'm just going to make up numbers here, but I think this is close. In 1925, they were trying to reroute the Colorado River for irrigation purposes here to Southern California. And in the process of doing that, there was a 100-year flood that wiped out everything and redirected the river, I guess. And it directed it into this salt pan or salt flat here in Southern California called the Salton Flat. So it filled up with water, and now it's a huge lake. It's like a mile wide and like 7 or 8 miles long. And it's so salinated that only one species of fish can live there, the tilapia. Can live there. And because of all the agriculture and stuff around it, they dump the fertilizers back in it. So you have algae blooms that soak up all the oxygen and kill the fish. So there's mass die-offs. The place is like a dystopian wasteland. I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there have seen pictures and stuff of it. So anyway, the story goes that way back hundreds of years ago, they think it potentially could have been a sea, like an extension of the Baja, where the Baja Peninsula is, what is that, the Bay of California, an extension of the Bay of California coming up. And during that time, there's two different stories. One was that a Viking ship came up, which, you know, there's rumors that the Vikings have explored other parts of America other than, I think, Newfoundland is where they've documented it. So they came up in there, did some exploring around, and some sudden change, an earthquake or something, caused the water level to drop drastically and quickly, stranding the ship. So, you know, obviously, they have no means of getting out, so these people eventually perish. Hundreds of years later, people report seeing the hull of a ship sticking out of the side of a mud bank, or, you know, they find an ore or something strange in that area that kind of hints to there being a ship in the middle of the desert or 100, 200 miles from the ocean. So I don't know if there's truth to any of this. This is actually one of our stretch goals that hopefully we get enough money. We want to do a little featurette on this and try to put our spin on what may be going on here and see if we can uncover this thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those wonderful, wonderful treasure hunting stories, I suppose, is probably the best aspect to these, because the weirdest thing is obviously it's a boat miles from anywhere, really, that shouldn't be there. But also there are some interesting parallels, because I think obviously the most famous treasure hunt in the world is probably Oak Island, which is still seven seasons in, I'm still watching. I'm not sure how many episodes you guys are ahead of us over there, but that's one of those stories that as a child, when I started reading books about mysteries and ghosts and the paranormal, Derek, that was one of the stories that was in them there. So to see it now that, you know, somebody's essentially almost digging the whole island up to finally get to the bottom of this, I've seen enough to realize there's something clearly odd has gone on that island. Might not be anything that we're expecting at all. It could be something that nobody even considered could be the reason, but clearly someone's done a lot of work on that island for some reason.
Yeah, I'm not caught up on the show by any means. I think I'm a season or two behind. But when I do have free time, which I don't anymore, but when I do, I'd like to sit down and watch shows like that. Josh Gates does a bunch of these treasure hunting shows. There's Jesse James Treasure. There was a treasure in my area growing up. There was a Confederate soldier that basically raided his way all the way up to the north and crossed through the town that I lived in. And somewhere in this 50-mile span, he hid a payload of gold bars, and no one's ever found them. So we don't know if that kind of story's true or not, but that doesn't stop people from looking for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those intrinsical treasure hunts that America is famous for, because I think the other one that most people will know is obviously the Dutchman's gold mine.
Yeah,
The man staggering into the local town on his last legs with his, you know, a multi-million fortune hidden. If you can just decipher his map, you'll find it. And the other aspect of these kind of stories and things, Derek, that I always find fascinating is also the aspect of what it does to the people who end up spending their entire lives trying to find these things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you can equate that to not only treasure, but you look at, like, Stanton Friedman. Like, that guy spent his entire life researching UFOs and died with no answers. Yeah. I mean, I know I'm going to be in that same boat, but it's kind of depressing if you think about it. But at the other end, the search is so rewarding, and it's what drives many of us to continue on with this insane hobby. So
yeah,
it's two sides of the coin, I'll be honest with you. Like, it could go either way.
Yeah, I mean, I like all facets of nature, be it the paranormal and paranatural. So I'm always cheered whenever anybody rediscovers a thought to be extinct species, or we discover a new species.
Yeah.
I mean, it just blows my mind sometimes. It seems you can read the news reports sometimes, and it's like buses, as we say here in the UK. You wait an hour for one, and then three turn up. And, you know, it seems like a domino effect. And that sometimes happens in paleontology as well with dinosaurs, because occasionally it seems like they find five new species in a week.
Yeah, it's almost like they find a pocket of bones or something. I really wish there was more time in the day to really get into some of the, like, dinosaur paleontology just fascinates me. I have no time whatsoever to do any research or interest in it, aside from watching a documentary once a year. But just little things like that, any kind of mystery that hasn't been solved just has my attention completely. There's a gentleman out here in New Mexico, Forrest Fenn, who was a millionaire art collector, that he developed cancer in the 80s, and they said he was going to die. So he put together a treasure box with a lot of gold coins and stuff, and buried it somewhere in the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
And this thing's still there. He actually survived. Mm. He's still alive to this day.
Yes.
And that treasure is still out there. And he's got a poem basically telling you how to do it. So any free time I have goes to that as far as treasure hunting is concerned. I read the poem and I look at a map, and then 6 months later, I try it again. And one of these days, I'm going to find that box of treasure.
Yeah, I'm aware of him because I saw him on an episode with Josh Gates. He's a bit of a character, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he is. Yeah. Yeah, desert people, man, I'm telling you, they're a different breed.
Absolutely. Yeah, one of a kind. Unique, I think, is one of their strong facets.
That's the best way to describe desert people, is unique, because every one of them is different from the last one you just met.
Absolutely.
And I love it. I love it. Oh. And we learned that a lot on our we shot a trailer for the documentary. In fact, if you go to the Kickstarter, you can watch it. And we met a lot of interesting characters there. And I was just so excited. Like, all these people had crazy stories, and it's just the characters that you run into is just so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, before I let you return to lockdown, as we have here, hands across the ocean, Derek.
I'm not a good swimmer, so put me on the edge.
me and you neither, my friend. I would be clinging on. Yeah, Titanic had been no good me at all.
Yeah, me either.
So, in regards to the show and developing, what I mean, obviously the growth of the show, you know, as we've touched on a couple of times, it has been phenomenal, and I think that's testament to, you know, to the hard work you and the rest of the team, because obviously, you know, you've got a fantastic team, especially for the social media side of the show, who are a fabulous bunch, and I'm lucky enough.
I love those guys.
A couple of them I've got to know very well, Addy especially. I'm usually Addy's go-to skeptic, which I take with great comfort, and makes me feel quite humble that she relaxes. Yeah. She thinks enough of my opinion to ask me about certain things, which is lovely when anybody treats you with that respect. So I have a lot of time for everybody involved in the team. So did you envisage that it would end up becoming a multi-tentacled kraken, as it were, Derek?
No, I didn't. I saw the potential, though. I wouldn't have started it if I didn't. You know, I saw the potential for this to grow and to be something new in the paranormal world, because let's face it, a lot of the stuff we get is fairly stale, because there's only so many ways to present this. And this really isn't a new way. It's just a slightly different way that feels a little bit different. So I have that going for me. But there's big things in the works. I'd really love to turn this into a TV show later on down the line somehow. So I've been taking a ton of meetings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Possibly doing some sort of spinoff show in the coming years to try to get more content out. Or maybe I've even explored like a daily show, like doing this daily or something along those lines. It all really depends on the kind of income that it brings in, if I can afford to do this kind of work. And there's a lot of variables that come into play, and people don't really see them from the listener end, but we're working pretty hard. We're kind of like a duck in water, if that makes sense. Like, we look normal on the top, but just kicking like hell.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly where you're coming from. Right, I think the last thing I'm going to touch on, Derek, before I, like I say, let you return to lockdown and trying to keep busy, is obviously, I mentioned it in the introduction, is Paranormal Caught on Camera. So how did that come about? Because I found that quite an interesting show, and there's, like I say, obviously, you're one of those people, whenever I see you on anything or I hear you interviewed on another show, I'm, you know, as I said on your Facebook group the other week, I'm one of those people that when somebody comes on your show and goes, "Hi, my name's Steve from Texas," I'll go, "Hi, Steve," even though I'm in my own kitchen.
Too. I do it too. When I listen for the first time, I always like wave or say hi. Yeah. I don't know why I do it. Just super weird.
Yeah. So whenever I see you, Derek, or like Shannon or Ryan Sprague or somebody, I'm going, "Hey," like that. So where did that opportunity come from? Were you kind of contacted through the show, or was that something you got from your previous sort of employment in the industry?
Oh, no. My wife actually worked for reality TV before we moved up here, and she had no – she worked for Ghost Hunters, but she was more of the social media side of it. Right. So I kept trying to get her to, you know, get me the in, but of course that never works. So no, yeah, you know, I left the industry. I had no interest in working in film, had no interest in working in TV. And I got randomly in 1 week, I got 3 different phone calls from 3 different productions that said, "Hey, can you come in? You're an hour, 2 hours away, whatever. Can you drive in and shoot this?" And for some reason I said yes, even though I'm not afraid to admit I was terrified.
Yeah.
Being on national television like that, or cable television, I guess you should say, it's still terrifying, because you look at the lens and you think, "Oh, how many people are looking yes. back at me right now?" Yeah. And it gets in your head.
Yeah.
So I did the first show, which was actually called In Search of Monsters. And surprisingly, they put me on the show and it all seemed to go just fine. And then, like, the next week I filmed with Paranormal Caught on Camera. And at the time, we thought it was a one-off. Mm. They were just going to do a pilot episode. I really didn't think anything would come of it. And then next thing I know, we're 2 seasons in. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but it looks like 3 seasons might be happening. So
fantastic.
It was kind of a happy accident. And it's, again, I'll be honest, it's taken me a long time to become comfortable with it. Like, it wasn't something that came naturally to me. I'd always worked behind the camera and not so much in front of it. So getting in front of the camera was a little bit daunting, but it's been a lot of fun. It's been a really cool experience. It's helped the show grow. It's helped us get more diverse calls, more calls in general. And it's just a lot of fun to see how it affects people's lives. People come up to me at different conventions and stuff and talk about different clips that they've seen in it and give their opinion. And anytime you can engage with people and have something to engage with them about, it's always fun. So it's a perfect way to extend the brand, I suppose, and get people to realize who I am, the person behind the microphone.
Yeah.
A little bit, at least.
Absolutely. And like I say, I like the variation in the show, because once again, it's one of those shows where I've stumbled across a couple of people who I wasn't aware of in the field, and I'm interested to know more about them and what they've done. So
yeah.
Has it helped you kind of, as you say, obviously you've had the kind of increase in your media profile in regards to how it's brought in the now some more callers for everybody. So is it continuing to move in that kind of positive direction? I know, like, famously, I listened to one of your roundtable shows where you were discussing the potential of wearing other podcast t-shirts and causing trouble, which made me laugh for far longer than it should have. I thought that segment of the conversation was hilarious. It really did make me laugh. I'm just imagining people causing a ruckus at certain conferences. So is that something that you've found has also gone into the when you've done the conferences? Because I know you had a busy year with that last year.
Yeah, I found that anytime I can get out there other than the show, it obviously is going to help the numbers of, you know, the listeners and the submissions. And for me, it's twofold. It's not just the listens. I also need the submissions, or this doesn't continue. So I also need to push that. But it didn't grow my show as much as I thought it did. If I'm honest, I think it maybe went the other way around. I think a lot of my listeners were then turned on to Paranormal Caught on Camera. Mm. But that's perfectly fine with me. Yeah. As long as people are listening and watching, I don't care where they come from.
Yeah.
But there's something I should point out, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this pretty much ever, but the show is grassroots. I've never paid for advertising or anything on the show. So I haven't run ads on Facebook or anything like that. Maybe I did for the first week that I did it, maybe spent $10 on it. Mm. But from that point on, it was all organic. So any growth the show has been word of mouth almost completely.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in the same boat. I've been very fortunate to have some people I respect a great deal mention my show, which is ingrained other people to come and find me. So it's a weird thing. It's one of those, because I've just, this is, you know, just after a year now, and I look back how my first episode I think took me 9 hours to put together.
That sounds about right. I think mine was the same way. I recorded it like 6 times.
Yeah, what I could tell you about podcasting a year ago, I could probably fit on the back of a postage stamp. So it's weird how doing something I enjoy and speaking to people like yourself, you know, people I respect and have so much time for, Derek. I just find it such an enjoyable way to upskill myself.
Well, I tell you what, I don't get to listen to a lot of podcasts, but I am subscribed to yours and I do catch it on occasion. And I get pretty excited, especially when you have somebody on that I know and want to like get to know a little better. Because you ask the right questions. You don't ask the bottled questions. You don't get the canned responses. Tonight, you've definitely asked me questions that made me think. So good on you.
Well, yeah, I'm probably like you are, Derek. You know, I know you mentioned it earlier that, you know, occasionally we'll listen to shows and I'll be thinking, why aren't you asking that? Or so I'm just nosy about certain things. And like you say, I think there are certain subjects and certain topics that have been not done to death, but I think most people could tell you certain aspects of certain phenomena, if you know what I mean.
So, sure, yeah.
I always generally want to know more about someone who, like I say, I appreciate their talent in whichever field they come from, be they an author or a podcaster or a creator of any kind of art content. So I just hope that people find it enjoyable and understand that I'm hopefully doing what they want me to.
Well, I can tell you what, you've got some guests on there that make me envious. So I'm definitely in good company. Whatever you're doing it right. And it's very enjoyable. So keep being nosy if that's what it takes.
Thank you. Well, I always think it's also important. It's nice to be nice, Derek, as we say.
It's always nice to be nice. Yeah,
absolutely. So listen, thank you very much for joining me today. Where can everybody keep up to date with you and your work and find out more about Monsters Among Us?
This is the hardest part of an interview. Remember, all this stuff. Monsters Among Us can be found basically anywhere that you find podcasts. I can't think of any place that you can't find at least the newest episodes. If you want to listen to back stuff, go to the website, which is monstersamonguspodcast.com, and you can find it there under the episodes link. What else? The show, the Paranormal Con on Camera, is on Travel Channel, at least in the States, Travel Channel every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Okay. And, Paul, maybe you can tell me when it's on in the UK, because I don't know.
It's on Wednesdays at 10 p.m. on Blaze.
Oh, well, it was pretty close. And the last one is Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle. Man, I was struggling with that. You can search that title on Kickstarter. You can find our campaign there. There's a short teaser video that David and I already shot. So you can kind of get a proof of concept. We're working closely with my good buddy, Will Rogie, who shoots, he shoots like drifting races and stuff here in the US, actually worldwide. He's in Japan all the time, in the UK. Basically there's a race he's shooting it. So he's lending his talents to this production as well. So it's going to look amazing, and hopefully we dig up some good stuff. So if you have it in your heart, maybe pledge a couple bucks and help us make that film.
Absolutely. And I'll put links in the show notes to everything and guide everybody where they need to go to, Derek. So listen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate that.
You are most welcome, my friend. So listen, take care and all the very best with, like I say, a wonderful show. And all the best in your future endeavours.
Thank you. You stay safe out there.
You too. During my interview with Derek, there was one particular call that we both spoke about, which, in hindsight, we probably refer to now as a Skinwalker call. Derek has very kindly allowed me to play that call that sent chills up and down my spine. So I hope you enjoy it. And once again, thank you to Derek for allowing me to include this as a little epilogue at the end of this week's show. Enjoy.
Hi, Derek. This is Alan in Mesa, Arizona again. I was recently listening to episode 3 of season 4 and Caitlin's account of the Skinwalker. I've had a similar experience living in Arizona all my life. This event happened in approximately 1990 on the San Carlos Indian Reservation in southeast Arizona. It was late at night. I had been to the car races in Globe and was returning home, driving down US 70 to Safford. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning and I was fairly tired. I was only 17 years old and I was driving along and it started to slow down because I was getting sleepy. I just passed through the town of Peridot and I don't know, I had probably slowed down to about 40, 45 miles an hour. As I was driving along, I heard a tapping on the side window of my truck. Not thinking about it, I was concentrating on the road. It tapped again and then a bang. And I looked over and there seemed to be a person running next to me on the road. So it kind of freaked me out. I dropped her down the third gear and took off. Got down the road a few more miles. Kind of woke up by now. And as I went through the small town of Bayless, got past there, started getting sleepy again. So I began slowing down. And again, there was a tapping on my window and then a bang. Looked over and it was the same figure running next to me. It was a tall, pale man with red stripes painted on his body. And he was keeping pace with me, like I said, at about 40, 45 miles an hour. So I again switched gears and took off. With that being said, I was driving through the San Carlos Indian Reservation, which is an Apache reservation, to reference Caitlin's story in the episode. And I got home, kind of freaked out, now wide awake. It's right around 2:30 now in the morning. Talked to my dad, didn't really say anything to him about the situation, just that I got in late. Fast forward to 1993, I'm stationed in 29 Palms, California with the Marines and talking with my roommate, telling the same story, and he goes absolutely ghost white. And I said, "What's wrong, Johnny?" He had a roommate earlier that lived in Lordsburg, New Mexico, that drove the same route that I drove when he went home on leave and had the exact same experience only 2 years previous to that. So that would be 1991. So just want to give a little bit of light on the Caitlin's experience and hope you like the story. I will call him back in more again. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.